Come on, start the test.
Campus clown underwent an accidental brain transplant with a high-speed computer. The whole world was after his head. Now the young generation gets into gear, and the laughs are all on the establishment. The computer wore tennis shoes. Coming soon.
Welcome to No Escape from Kurt Russell on the Siskoid Cinema feed, the show that explores the filmography of Kurt Russell and his mystique. I'm Siskoid. A long time ago, blogger Dave Campbell coined the Kurt Russell factor to explain why there are performers that we will gladly see anything they're in, regardless of the movie synopsis, because Kurt Russell is that guy. And we'll test out that theory film by film, and today we're going back to 1969, and the computer wore tennis shoes. A silly Disney comedy about a teenager who gets a computer in his head? Yeah, but Kurt Russell is in it. So, to help me discuss this film is Batman Family Reunion's Sean M. Myers, who reportedly has a great love for the Dexter Riley movies. Hi, Sean.
Hello, I am beep, beep, happy to be here.
Damn, I'm podcasting with AI. I didn't know. Funnily enough, this movie, when it came out, there is a critic who said this about it. Let's use that as an introduction. He said, "Alas, the movie itself comes out looking like it had been made by a computer." So in 1969, some sort of AI fear already. But we'll see if we liked it, etc. It's true what I said, that you're a particular fan of these.
Obviously, like, Disney's super well known for all of the animated features over the years. But their live action, obviously Mary Poppins is a classic. But they really did, and I don't mean this derogatory, like they did like Workaday, live action comedies, dramas, all of those kind of things. And definitely part of it's nostalgia, because I grew up with them. But still, I mean, I'm lucky enough that I can still watch it with, I guess, my nostalgia glasses and still really enjoy it. And there were several times. Now, I've seen the computer wore tennis shoes probably more than 20 times in my life. But even it probably had been like 5 years since I watched it the last time. But there were times that I still laughed at it this most recent time.
Sure. I saw this as a kid on, I guess, it was The Wonderful World of Disney or whatever that show was.
Yep.
That sort of stripped it down. Maybe it was in several episodes.
Yep.
I feel like I kept seeing the Dexter Riley movies and thinking, oh, it's that movie. And then they would switch up the powers on me. It's like, no, wait. you know?
I think for me, part of that charm is, so like growing up, like the Ma and Pa Kettle movies were on like Sunday mornings, you know, like at, I don't know, like 8 o'clock or 10 o'clock or whatever. But I think this was the first movie, quote unquote, franchise that was like made when I was alive that wasn't like particular sequels. Like it wasn't Superman, Superman 2, Superman 3. Like it's not the computer wore tennis shoes. The Strongest Man wore tennis shoes. The Invisible Man wore tennis shoes. Like you wouldn't really know it's a sequel until you start watching it and you see, oh, it's Dexter. Oh, and he's in college. So I think like putting that together as a kid adds into the fondness of these movies for me.
Yeah, I was always confounded. It was like, oh, I recognize this movie. And then it was a different movie. Yeah.
and especially seeing it on The Wonderful World of Disney, I could see where if you didn't pay attention that it was a movie, you could kind of think that this was a TV show.
And I say The Wonderful World of Disney, but of course I mean the French version. So I'm a child in this. So as a child, I watched French dubs on English language films. And I don't know which version of this. You know, I would have watched English and French by the time I was, 10. So who knows? But I have a feeling that I probably I don't know what the title would have been, but I would have seen this in French, really. And I haven't seen it since, you know, when we all got Disney Plus for a variety of material. I was sort of curious, and I went and watched the third one, the Invisible Man one.
That's the second one.
Okay, then I saw The Strongest Man. Yeah, that's the one I saw. So I didn't know which one was first. I just watched that one.
Right, yeah.
And I was like, oh, I'm a little lost. You know, it's like they seem to all know each other already. But when I watched this one, similarly, I felt like we sort of jump in the middle of things anyway.
Yeah, you actually, yeah, so there are three movies. But yeah, you could watch any one of them, and they don't have to be followed in order, because they never ever reference, you know, it's not like, oh, remember when you were a junior and you were really smart? Or remember back when you made the invisibility formula? Like, none of that carries over. Like, it's all like...
Except the villain, right? It's like the same villain.
Well, I'm hoping that you have a section about the Disneyverse and the criminal justice system. Because it does astound me that the same bad guy is in all three movies. Now, I'm happy... And we'll get to it because of who he's played by.
Sure.
But yeah, like, it does astound me that they have the same villain.
Yeah. So, okay. Let me just do a quick synopsis. We're about to spoil the heck out of it. So, but broadly goes like this. College students manage to convince the town's big businessman, AJ Arno, to donate a computer to their college. When the problem student, Dexter Riley, tries to fix the computer, he gets an electric shock and his brain turns into a computer. Now he remembers everything he reads. Unfortunately, he also remembers information which was in the computer's memory, like the illegal businesses Arno was involved in. And then stuff happens. Shenanigans. Before we get into the details, let's talk about this Disney era for Kurt Russell, right? So he starts out as a child actor, then moves into these teenager parts, you know, in sort of these Shaggy Dog stories for Disney. Disney has a lot of these.
So the college is Medfield College, and that was actually introduced in The Absent-Minded Professor.
Right, and then Flubber was the sequel. So it's all the same college where wacky science can happen.
Yes, yeah. And also, like, you talked about Kurt Russell being like a child star. I think we kind of forget that he was a child star. And I think part of that is there was never really like a star vehicle for him. Like, he never played like the same other than Dexter Riley. But also, too, in his movies, he was never really like the star. Like, he was never in a version of whatever, like Huck Finn or, you know, like any kind of thing like that. But I will say, anyone who is listening to this loves Kurt Russell. But definitely, like, his first Disney movie, Follow Me, Boys, which is basically about, like, the scouting program. His role, and especially for a Disney movie, like, he plays a kid that has a rough home life. And again, even for a Disney movie, like, his home life is rough, and it's portrayed rough. And he does a fantastic, and I know this is the computer wore tennis shoes, but he does a great job in that movie. So I absolutely, if you care at all about Kurt Russell's Disney movies and you haven't seen Follow Me, Boys, definitely watch that, because it is fantastic. He does a great job.
Okay, I'll pull it down my list because I have it, or maybe I have, but, you know, I don't know, because this is all from my youth, probably, right, when I was watching these things and without the proper identifiers, etc. He starts in a place, like, if we look at this movie, it's already a genre movie, right?
Yes.
He's doing science fiction, and he will become known as a big... He's in action films, but a lot of that action is in science fiction and horror films, or fantasy, or, you know, there's something... I don't know if he loves the genre stuff, but he certainly fell into it. And already here, he's, you know, even in the Disney era, it's more like a fluffy, silly fantasy element, but it's still that kind of stuff. It's still the genre stuff.
And it is funny, like, watching it now, it dawns on me, like, how, like, crime ridden like the Disney live action movies were, like That Darn Cat, that bank teller gets kidnapped, like, and it is funny how, like, you have like these crimes, but it's like a Disney movie, so it's, I mean, there are like bad crimes, but it's portrayed obviously like on a G-rated level. And I'm wondering, like, why little kids like to watch crime being stopped. So I guess that's the factor in it.
It's usually a goofy crime. Yeah. You know, it's like crime written by someone who doesn't know what crime is. Right. Or for people who don't know what, you know, how the justice system works.
Yeah.
Basically.
They have the mob, but it's definitely not like The Sopranos.
No. And I've seen a lot of kids movies against my will. Not because of kids. This is gonna make me sound ridiculous, but I am. So there we go. There used to be a time when I used to throw these big Oscar parties. Mm-hmm. When I did, there was always a bunch of side events. And one of these was off the Oscar pool, right? You write down what you think is going to happen, and then you win something at the end. What we won was a stash of DVDs that were just crap. So people would, you would like divest your own collection right, of yeah. crap. You would put it in the box. But most people, what they did, they didn't have a big collection. So they went to, I can only imagine, I'm going to say the convenience store, and grab something that looked like crap and put it in the box. Now, what was funny about this is that I won every year. I was just too good at it.
Right.
So almost every year, not every year, but almost every year, I would win. Because I would win, I felt like I needed to give them give something back. And the thing I gave back is that, well, if I win, I will watch these movies and I will review them on my blog, you know, guaranteed. So now, now we're going to get the crappiest crap. You know, so kids' movies were part of that. You know, it's like he's going to hate this. And then I would have to watch it and I would have to review it. So watch it seriously. So I've seen a lot of these kids' movies that I didn't want to see. And usually they have this element where the movie doesn't really understand how banking works, but it's got a banking fraud in it.
Yeah. You know?
And it's painful because it's not the real thing and you realize it's not real. And it's like, that's not how it works. But that's what you're telling kids, that's how it works. And if you're not going to use a real crime and kids don't understand the crime anyway, why are you using this element at all? So it's kind of a trope that shows up in a lot of kids' movies. Yeah. You need the bad guy. You know, why is he a bad guy? Why are they a bad guy? And they're bad guys because they do bad things. In this case, running gambling dens.
Yeah.
Gambling dens and kidnapping university students.
Yeah, it's funny. I even forgot about the kidnapping. I just focused in on the gambling.
But then whatever happens is like you talked about the justice system being ridiculous earlier. The real justice in a movie like this is the full-on slapstick punishment that the villains get. They don't get jail. They get paint thrown at them. They get humiliated in public. That's usually what it is, because I think kids understand that.
Yeah.
That's got to be it. But it was interesting to see Kurt Russell at that age. First of all, it's very rare that he has the voice that we associate with him today. So he really was quite young. How young was he in this 1969?
Oh, actually, I don't know.
He was born in 51.
I was told there would be no math.
He was born in 51, so he's 18 in this.
With that, I was going to bring that up. I love the fact that they look like college students, because almost always in Hollywood, the kids do not look like – that's one thing I hate about Grease. Oh, my God. Grease is
everybody's
like
30.
Yes, they're 30. And I don't even want to say they're 30-year-olds. They look like 30-year-olds who are acting like they're in high school. But,
yeah.
But I don't have that problem at all with it. Like, I do think they look like college – now, again, this is 1969 college kids. So they even bring up, like, unrest – like civil unrest and college unrest,
sure.
But you don't really see anything like that. Although, like, the hair on the guys is, for a lot of the guys, it is kind of shaggy. It is kind of long. So I think it is fashionable.
I mean, it is like they just went through 1968, which was like a year of riots, et cetera. It's 1969. The unrest is actually a mention. It's not the kids talking about unrest. It's the dean of the school. Yeah. And he's, I got to say, I worked in a university for too long. And I worked for students. I worked with the student body and I was like a professional activist, student activist. The way you dealt with the university, the president of the university, the dean or whatever you want to call him in this instance, this is true to life. We hit like a milestone in the student movement history, and we had like a book written, and we had like there's a lot of research, and I helped work on that project, and seeing the history of the university through the lens of the student movement, there were deans like this in the 60s and 70s who did not want students to assemble. It's just, you're just asking for communism. And it was stuff like that. So students were treated much the same way. This is comically done, but they were treated the same way that the dean here treats them. Oh, there's unrest. But they're just all around the same picnic table. Like, we know spying on him and everything. But still, it's just like just students at a picnic table, and he sees it as a threat, you know. These problem students, we got to kick him out. And as it turns out, they're not that disruptive. Well, they're disruptive in a comical way, but it's not unrest. That's his point of view.
Well, and also, like, they're, you know, like, quote unquote disruption. Like, they're not, whatever, like, overthrowing I don't even want to say government. They do want to learn. Like, they want to learn about computers. They want to learn, like, they want to keep Quigley, like, in charge so that they can learn the computer. Like, I know it's not implicitly said, but this almost makes me think of how Peter Parker is in a school for science. It helps me if I think that this is kind of like the case where, like, they're there and maybe not, they're not great students, but they are very interested in their science courses.
I mean, the other weird thing here, and they only say it at the end, is that when they reveal that Medfield is it's a private school, and, you know, the public school, the state college is rolling in money.
Yeah.
But the private school is really having trouble. I was like, really? Is that how that would work?
Yeah.
Because you would want a private school, that would mean probably all these kids are rich or have rich parents, and you want to keep them on just for that reason.
I think there is evidence that these kids are rich because, like, the cars that they drive are, and I'm not even a car person, but their cars are phenomenal. Like, Dexter Riley's, like, dune buggy is great. And then even, I forget, like, the blonde-haired guy is at Joe. Like, his car is fantastic. Like, that little blue number. Oh, my God.
And they're able to work on schemes that probably require funds.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Getting all the truck and the paint equipment.
Right. All the painting equipment and the, of course, bugging the.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, that I think ties in with, like, how, like, they're science minded.
They're not really interested in following the rules is the thing. Is they're just rule breakers. And if we're going to talk about Kurt Russell, I think him as a rule breaker is kind of his MO. Like, even at this point, it makes sense to have him part of this sort of gang. And he goes on to play a lot of people who are on the edge or over the edge in terms of following the rules.
Oh, yeah.
There's something there. It's part of that continuum still. Let's talk about that villain. There are two villains, a foil and a villain.
Right, yeah. Right?
The foil is the dean.
Yeah, yeah.
Under pressure to keep the school afloat, doesn't like to have students that are not good academically because that doesn't look good. The numbers, wherever. And so he's the foil. He's sort of the idiot who gets, he's so self-serious that anything the kids do humiliates him, embarrasses him. And that's how we, the audience, win against him. And then we have this mobster. He's supposed to be a reputable businessman. But then as it turns out, he's shady. Mm-hmm. And he's played by Cesar Romero.
Yeah.
So this is Kurt Russell versus the Joker.
Cesar Romero is fantastic. And the funny thing is, when I saw this as a kid, I don't even know that I put together that he is the Joker just because of the makeup and, like, he's not as over the top as he is as the Joker. Now, obviously, as an adult, I can totally see it. But even as a kid, I didn't realize that Joker had a mustache. So that's
right.
Talking about the dean. So the dean is played by an actor named Joe Flynn. The thing I want to bring up is, like, the characters' voices, like the voices of the two deans and Cesar Romero, like all of these are so distinct. So maybe not Cesar Romero, but the other two are definitely like character actors. You know, you've seen them in a million things, but their voices are so, like, I can't help but think, especially for this time, I wonder if they had a career in radio earlier in their careers and then, like, transitioned over into movies. Because, like, just pretty much from the first line of dialogue that each of them says, like, you get what kind of character they are.
Right.
Joe Flynn is so up and down and kind of amazing. Mm-hmm. But then,
like, the other dean is all talking like this and welcome to the.
I'm from a state university and our prestige goes way beyond what that sounds like. Yeah, no, exactly. And, I mean, Joe Flynn, he plays these obsequious characters in a lot of Disney films.
Yeah.
The Love Bug being a principal one that a lot of people have seen. You know, he also plays this kind of character. The dueling deans, right? That's part of this whole equation. It's why when you said that Kurt Russell doesn't necessarily in these movies, isn't always like the star of it, or it's not a vehicle for him. That's the case here, because there's so much going on, and like he's the one that gets the superpowers.
Yeah.
But when he's introduced, it's almost like he's just one of the kids. You don't notice that he's supposed, except that we recognize him, you don't notice that he's supposed to be more important than the other ones at the beginning.
Right, yeah.
There's no fanfare when he shows up, you know? If we go through the movie, the setup is the kids want this computer because their favorite teacher wants this computer. We have William Shallert, who was like in Star Trek and a bunch of things, who plays this teacher, like the one guy that is hip enough.
I know him most from being Patty Duke's father on the Patty Duke Show.
Oh, yeah. Okay, sure. Yeah, I remember that. So he wants the computer. He's been told, no, all the budget. The budget's been spent. We can't spend it on this. Then the kids think up, oh, well, they're buying this computer from Arno, this businessman. And it so happens that Dexter Riley, he's used to work for this guy. Yes, he was just like janitorial, but
he would say hi to him in the elevator.
Right. So they're convinced. Sure. Let's go. He goes and asks Arno to forgo giving. That's what actually happens, is that, well, usually I give this much money to the school as a grant normally, but so I can't also give a computer. So we'll just give the computer and then you can forgo the normal money. So now the university has lost like $20,000.
Yes, yep.
Because they get a computer. Okay, that's like a $10,000 value, but also it was not budgeted for. And so all the stuff that is budgeted for, there's $20,000 missing. So the dean is particularly unhappy about this, but they do get the computer. In the middle there, we can sort of see that maybe Cesar Romero's character is not on the up and up. They're using this computer for
accounting. they're keeping the books.
That's how they calculate how much money they make at their various illegal venues. The first time they use the computer, it blows up. There's a part that like goes on the fritz. Our dude, Dexter Riley, says, I'll go to Radio Shack or whatever it is and get the thing, the part. And it's like, well, you don't have to do that. No, I want to. So, he's a good student in that he's not a good student in the terms of academics, because he's supposed to be studying for this big SAT type test. And he's not. How he thinks this is going to work is like, we've had like a couple of A's, it's time for a C, you know. So you see that he's a very bad student. They need to establish that he's kind of dumb.
Right.
But he's got a good heart. And they're all kind of technically minded, these kids, mm-hmm. even though they may not have good grades. And, you know, they're all on the probation list at this point, all of them.
Yes.
This is where it gets science fiction-y. He brings the part to the class. He fixes the computer. There's a thunderstorm, gets hit by lightning, and suddenly the computer is in his head.
And I cannot believe it took me until I was 55 years old to realize how much this is like the origin of the Flash.
There's no chemical, but
there's a computer call.
The way the science is shown here, even the Silver Age comic books would not have gone this wild.
Yeah.
Because when they check on him, he aces the test. Every answer correct in like 4 minutes. It's impossible. He must be cheating. But even if he's cheating, it's impossible. Like they check him up. And that's where that's the moment where I went, okay, that's what this is going to be. Okay.
What you're going to talk about is like the most silly, if I'm nice, inane, if I'm mean.
Like it is inane.
The over-the-top ridiculous makes no sense. But go ahead.
Yeah, there are two things that there are two tests. they look into his eyes. So they're like shining light in his retina. And inside his eye, you can see the actual computer. You know, the lights, the buttons of the computer. They're literally in his head.
Yeah.
And then they have like this brain scan where you actually see a brain and you see a lot of gambling stuff. Nobody clues in. But, you know, you see stuff that the computer thinks. Also, like bodacious babes or something. You know, things that are Dexter, things that are Arno's computer, mm-hmm. and things that are just science computer. Yeah. So at that point, it's like, okay, they're not even trying to make this believable. And throughout all this, I felt a little bit like, so is this like a little bit like a TV pilot? You know, like we mentioned that it ran on TV. It was obviously in the Wonderful World of Disney, et cetera. But it does feel like you're just watching a TV show where every week some shenanigan, mm-hmm. possibly somebody gets turned into a dog, you know, things happen. Things happen like that. Because the 60s had a lot of this kind of comedy. Bewitched.
Yeah, you had
Dream of Genie.
Bewitched, where Darren, whatever, would turn into a ventriloquist dummy or something, or like, yeah.
There was a lot of like high concept comedy. I mean, that's part of the problem for the university. Now that they've got a super smart student, he's not sure he wants to come back to the university. And I mean, if he knows everything,
why does he need to stay there? Yeah.
So, like, give him a degree and be done with it. But there's sort of a desperate thing about that, because now they want him on the trivia show. There's a TV show for university students where you can win big money for the university.
Well, and that is another thing that really draws me into this movie, especially because, like, I love Jeopardy. So I live in the Baltimore area, and we still have It's Academic, which technically isn't College Bowl, but it's like for high school students. But like every week, you know, students from the area high schools do like a trivia game. Like, and I love game shows and trivia. So the fact that like there's a Disney movie starring Kurt Russell and he's on a trivia team, I love it.
Here in Canada, in French Canada, for more than 25 years, from the 70s through the 90s, there was a show called Génie en Herbe, which was, means basically aspiring geniuses.
Okay.
And schools would compete across French Canada. So I think we had like our own regionals here in New Brunswick. Mm-hmm. And then there was like the Quebec ones were the bigger ones. And at the end, you would go to whoever won here went to the sort of finals with Quebec somewhere. So I think it was franchised in other French countries, some in Europe, some in Africa. When I was looking it up earlier, this was a committee at school. You could be part of this team and you would go on TV and you would defend your school with general knowledge. So it looked exactly like that. Well, it was like this, but it's not like answer in three parts. It wasn't that crazy.
Yeah.
You didn't need a computer brain, because like in the movie, the way that Dexter manages it is that he reads a whole encyclopedia set that is sponsoring this show. And all the answers are in the encyclopedia, but it's like, who would know all of this? It's kind of insane, but he can do it because he's got a computer brain. But, you know, you got other teams, obviously, that are doing well, too, you know, heading for the final. Ed Begley Jr. is one of the state finalists on the other side. So as first role, I think, uncredited. So that's amusing. So that's going to be going on. But before Dexter ever agrees to this, he goes like on a world tour. Mm-hmm. They make him famous. So that this is like usually when something crazy like this happens, it's got a local impact. But in this case, he goes all across the world and he shows how smart he is. He talks to everybody. He goes to an Apollo mission, which has to be, I had to track it down, winter of 1969, because they say he hasn't signed up for the spring session. So this has to be Apollo 9, March 3rd. It's the first crewed flight test of the lunar module. I'm a big Apollo fan, so I had to look it up.
Like, I have my trivia in with the movie. You have your Apollo in with the movie.
So that summer, they would go to the moon, you know. But at this point, they're still testing some. Apollo 9 and 10 were tests for the lunar module. He's just like showing up everywhere. It makes you think, yeah, the other movies don't. Isn't he like super famous to other people? But they sort of ignore it.
Right. And I think they do. And it's, again, I understand this is a Disney movie, but I do think they do a nice job of how he kind of gets big-headed. You know, he kind of like is blowing right off his friends, and then something happens to bring him back around to his friends and his college. And I do like that. I like that they again, it's a Disney movie, but I like that they do delve into that somewhat.
There was a point there early on when I thought, like you said, oh, he's really confident, which he wasn't normally academically. But then that leads to arrogance.
Yeah.
He's telling off TV presenters and yeah, stuff. So this could have gone another way. Like, I thought, okay, now the movie is going to the computer, the criminal computer, we have to say.
Like, yeah.
It's influencing his mind, and he's going to become more like a robot, or he's going to lose his empathy, something. But they sort of walk that back.
Yeah.
Again, maybe because it is a Disney movie. It can't go negative on its star.
He's not going to turn into Brundlefly.
No. So they bail him out of jail, the problem situation.
He gets caught up in A.J. Arno's like gambling. Like, A.J. Arno's henchman takes him out to Garibaldi's to get pizza, but it's actually a gambling joint. So he winds up in jail. Luckily, all of his friends bail him out, and that's what brings him back to the full.
They're throwing quarters on the, on the desk.
Yeah.
And then, so that, like, he realizes where his heart really is. He comes back to the university. He joins this Well, he joins, he creates this trivia team because he insists on having three of his truant friends with him who know nothing.
Yeah.
But I do love at the end, they make one of the know-nothings know the answer. Like, he's not the hero at the end. You know, it's going to be one of his friends. I like that little twist.
Yeah, I think that's great.
But of course, Arno doesn't take to this. During one of the broadcasts, an answer triggers some gambling information.
They talk about like how you can use apples to make liquor. And what is that commonly called? And he says Applejack. And we've learned earlier that A.J. Arno's like criminal alias is Applejack. And that, you know, because he's a computer, that kicks off all of the stats for A.J. Arno's gambling.
Right. It's not clear to anyone what this means, but he's talking like a computer, beep, you know, and everything. It's ridiculous again. But Arno, of course, panics. We got to kidnap this kid and do away with him. They're going to kill him. They're going to drown him in a lake or something.
Yeah.
So there is some villainy there. So it's kidnapping with intent to murder. He's not going to be showing up to the final, et cetera. Of course, everything is going to happen at the same time. But the kids, they figure he's in that particular house. They follow the bad guy to that house where he's being kept. Very quickly, they set themselves up as a painting crew, which is interesting because Siskoid Cinema hasn't had a lot of episodes to date. Well, one of these was about Leprechaun. So an episode of Fade In about Leprechaun. And in Leprechaun, there are some of the worst house painters on the face of the planet. It's like a ridiculous... They paint themselves more than the house. And I don't know if the movie knows it's that ridiculous. And in this case, the Medfield Paint Company, I love their slogan, we cover the county.
Oh, cover the county, yeah.
Cover the county, which is, they're pretty much, because it's one of the worst painting jobs I've ever seen.
And they're painting the house like green and orange.
Right. Somebody makes a crack about being a pumpkin because it's exactly those colors. It's like Halloween and they're just painting this up. And it's just like to surveil the house and find where Dexter might be kept.
So the kids are able to find Dexter. Dexter's in a trunk. The trunk falls like out of the house. They load the trunk onto the truck. The truck takes off. AJ Arno in Dexter's dune buggy is following them. And they have like, they're throwing like paint cans at them. They're like airbrushing the car behind them.
And then, of course, they do get to the TV station just in time for the show. And Dexter, at that point, Dexter's been hit in the head.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Or perhaps this would have happened anyway, but he starts to slow down. Like the computer answers are very hard to come by until at the end he's dry as a bone. And they win by a couple points.
Thanks to Skyler,
And I like how they play it. They're so used to him. And I'm thinking of that episode of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air where it's passed it to Will. They're supposed to be playing basketball. He's so good at basketball compared to the Bel-Air kids. The whole strategy is pass it to Will. And at the end, he has to learn that like maybe Carlton can throw the ball, you know, because he gets like his head gets inflated, kind of the same. So here, they're so used to Dexter knowing all the answers and they never have the answer that the way that they play it, it's like Skyler says, no, you know this one. You don't need the computer. You know this one. I told you, like, my relative lives in that town, etc. Yeah, so you know it then, Skyler. And so, he gives the right answer at the bell, and they win the championship. They win the states, and the university is saved?
For now.
I'm going to say the university is saved? That's essentially the plot of this. I know they remade it for television with Kirk Cameron as Dexter Riley. I've never seen that.
I refuse to watch it.
Okay. Yeah. That doesn't spark my interest. 1995, just after Growing Pains. I don't know. I haven't seen it. I don't want to see it. I don't think there's a reason to see it.
Right.
So it's amusing. I wouldn't call it like laugh out loud funny for me, but certainly amusing.
Yes. Enjoyable. Now, technically, there were parts that I like laughed out loud, you know, some because the movie wanted me to laugh out loud, some because I just found it funny.
There's some like references, weird reference that I caught that I wrote down in my notes here. One of the kids that gets put on probation when they're just announcing it, one of the kids is called Keith Richards.
Yeah.
Which has to be a scripted joke.
Because he was pop. I mean, people knew who Keith Richards were in 1969.
Right. So there are some like jokes in there where that still play.
When
and possibly others that don't.
When you were talking about references, it did really surprise me. So this is a Disney movie in 1969, and I understand they're college students, but during the trivia contest game, they bring out three paintings, and one of them is nude descending a staircase. But of course, right. It's abstract, so you know nothing is shown.
It's Duchamp, yeah.
But they talk about it, and he's like, you wouldn't see that. Like, they literally say the line, you wouldn't see that in Playboy. So just the right. fact that, like, they're talking about, like, a Playboy magazine in 1969 in a Disney movie.
Right. I mean, it's supposed to be for kids, but there's content there that they might be thinking, well, it's for university students because yeah. it's showing university students.
Yeah. That is one thing I do really like about the Disney live-action movies of this era. They really were family films. They weren't necessarily kids, like kids could watch it and enjoy it because there was a wacky, you know, like paint car chase, that kind of thing. But there also were things for adults to understand, and not even like a wink, wink or a nudge, nudge. I mean, just general, like if you look at whatever 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea or, you know, any of those movies, they are family movies. Like everyone in the family can watch it and enjoy some things together and get different things out of it.
So, when all is said and done, if we use the Gillis-Doran formula from podcast La Vista Baby, and we ask, is The Computer War 10 Issues a good movie? You would say yes.
I'm going to say yes, understanding why I'm saying yes. I can understand someone watching this and thinking, you know, it's just silly or, you know. But I do think it is a good movie. Like, it's an interesting premise. You get computer powers. You know, it affects you. You come back. You know, you help out your friends. Yes.
I would also say it's a good movie. I don't know. I'd have to watch the other two to see, but I think probably it's the best of the three.
This, I can unequivocally tell you, this okay. is the best of the three. Yeah, absolutely.
It's at least the best of the two that I've watched. but they're kind of all this kind of play at the same
they
level.
They are very, very similar. Yeah. So, like, literally, Something Happens to Dexter, which I think that was the original, like, name of the movie, Something Happens to Dexter.
Oh, really?
I think so, yeah. And, yeah, and then, like, you know, whatever. And it is very sci-fi, very superhero-y things that happen to him. But, obviously, he never adopts, like, a costumed identity or anything like that.
I get powers, yeah. and they kind of help me but screw up my life.
Yeah.
And then I lose them.
Yeah.
It's essentially the through line of each of these. But, you know, it's like, I think you could do worse. You know, that's kind of a Sunday afternoon kind of movie.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You get the kids in the room, maybe. Yep. You're just nostalgic for this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It plays pretty well. There are some jokes that are going to surprise you, moments that are going to surprise you. And, of course, Kurt Russell is in it. So let's ask, is The Computer War 10 Issues a good Kurt Russell movie?
So I'm actually, I don't know. I think I might split the difference on this. So especially like Disney being like this, this was still kind of like the holdover from like the studio system where each movie studio had their own stable of stars. So, you know, Kurt Russell had been making Disney movies at this point for, you know, I don't know, 5 years. So the fact that he was like in Disney movies, that's why he's here. Now, I will tell you, this movie is probably 10,000% better because Kurt Russell is in this movie. And the thing about Kurt Russell, and, you know, you'll probably get into this in other episodes. The thing about Kurt Russell is, like, he's likable. This is a compliment, and it's going to sound like it's not a compliment, but I promise it's a compliment.
Okay.
He's handsome, but in a normal everyday handsome, not like a movie star handsome, because sometimes like movie star handsome is too good looking that they're either like unapproachable or like it seems like you can't relate. But Kurt Russell, just because of his voice and how good looking, like he does seem relatable. Like you could, whatever, you could strike up a conversation with him, you could have a beer with him, like any kind of thing like that. So this movie is definitely better because it's Kurt Russell. This movie would have been made whoever was at the Disney studio at the time. But it is amazingly better because of his performance in it.
Okay. I'm not sure you answered the question, of course, but and I agree. Kurt Russell is the guy that seems really, I think we said that for Tombstone, which even though he's very unapproachable as a character there, I think he just has this sort of approachable,
yeah.
almost self-effacing quality sometimes in movies. And he's one of these handsome people who can do comedy well.
Yeah, yeah.
Who doesn't mind laughing at himself or seeming like he's got feet of clay or something. And in this case, I mean, obviously, now he's not in control of this project whatsoever at this point career. Yeah. He's young enough that his dad is in the movie. Did you know this?
I didn't know that. Who is his father? I don't know. Who is his father?
His father is Bing Russell, and he's one of the goons.
I didn't know that.
In the house, he's one of the gunmen.
Oh, wow. And I had it in my notes. Also, we were talking about Cesar Romero being the Joker. You know, Batman is in this movie as well.
Which Batman?
I know I can't say it correct, but the voice of Batman and Super Friends, Olan Sule or however you pronounce that name, the voice of Batman and Super Friends is the reporter when Kurt Russell lands like in the airplane. And he comes in and like the two girls are kissing him. That's the voice of Batman on Super Friends.
Okay, I'm going to say Olin Sewell.
Yeah, Olin Sewell. Yeah.
Well, wow. I didn't realize that. So it's pretty funny.
I didn't realize Kurt Russell's dad is in it.
That's pretty funny.
One more reason for me to go back and watch this again.
Yeah. Also, if you're looking for voice actors, Frank Welker is in this.
Oh, yeah.
Famous. And here he's like, it's one of his few live action roles. He's one of the kids, I guess. There's some stars in the making in this, not just Kurt Russell. So that's kind of fun. But yeah, he was chaperoned, I guess, on this thing. His dad's on set. Yeah, I'm going to say that if I answer my own question, is it a good Kurt Russell movie? I think it's got the elements of what we think of as Kurt Russell movies are going to have. The genre element. I'm the hero, but there's also a lot of comedy around me. The feet of clay type thing. I think it's on its way to becoming a Kurt Russell movie. He doesn't really have his mystique yet, but it's sort of building it.
Yeah.
This is like the teenage version of what he's going to be doing later.
Oh, yeah. That's a really good way to put it. Yeah.
Then I better end the show now.
You might have a future in this.
Before I say something stupid. All right. Well, thanks for indulging in some Russell mania with me today, Sean. Maybe you want to tell the folks where they can find you, what you're working on right now, what's happening at the Batman Family Reunion.
Absolutely. So the first Wednesday of every month, my podcast partner and cousin, Bat Cousin, Paul Keen, and I talk about an issue of Batman Family / Detective Comics from the 70s. We love it. Our listeners are such great Bat Cousins, and they add a lot of information to the show, which we appreciate. Thank you, guys. Thank you, everyone.
You're always like playing it like it's some sort of family barbecue. And people have responded to that. It's like, it is kind of a family thing. I feel like you have like a great connection with the listeners. And if you're not a listener yet, I heartily recommend you go to the barbecue.
We have a very several many back episodes that you can listen to and dive right in.
So I'll let you go back to the theater. I'll play a trailer and then be back with your feedback on our previous episode in which Chris Franklin and I discussed Tombstone.
Hey, Sean, did you know that Batman Family Reunion is expanding?
Oh my god, what? Our episodes are now going to be 3 hours long?
No. Now that we have moved into Detective Comics, we are going to see stories starring other members of the, let's say, extended Batman family, like the Human Target.
Well, he's a detective.
The Demon.
He's been in Batman Family before.
Elongated Man.
He's a detective.
Red Tornado.
He's been in Batman Family before.
Black Lightning.
Ooh, he's cool.
And the Atom.
He's small. I'm excited by the upcoming artists. Not only are we still going to see my favorite, Michael Glorious Golden, but we will see art by Don Newton, Dick Giordano, Irv Novik, Jose Delbo, Johnny Craig, and even Steve Ditko and Dan Spiegel.
Awesome, but we won't forget the original stars. We'll see Robin return to the big top and Babs discover a family secret. Man-Bat teams up with Jason Bard, Batman teams up with Batgirl, and we will finally get an all-new Alfred story. We will see villains like Maxie Zeus, the Riddler, the Crime Doctor, and the Truckers.
But Paul, you know people say that the best part about the reunion is getting to interact with our Bat Cousins. I personally think it's all of the food, but I understand their point of view. We are continuing our guest list, including some repeat visits, but also some new Bat relatives. We love that our show has become a real family reunion, and we can't wait for you to hear what we have planned. That's the Batman Family Reunion on all of your podcast apps, only on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
You can't escape Kurt Russell, and you can't escape the feedback section. So here we go. Your comments on our coverage of Tombstone, myself and Chris Franklin. So Captain Entropy says, I was so excited to see this on my podcast feed that one of my daughters asked what I had gasped about. That's fun. If it couldn't be me, I'm glad it was Chris. The laudanum crack was hilarious. I don't remember ever seeing or hearing the trailer you used before. This movie is so much better and so much richer as a story than that trailer would lead its viewer to believe. Chris Pine gets in on that, says, did Tombstone really have Peter Gabriel's The Rhythm of the Heat as the background music on the trailer? That's an odd choice. Now, Russell, in a lot of his performances, gives a film exactly what it needs. And like Chris pointed out with Tombstone, it sometimes means letting other actors chew the scenery while he stays the steady hand. And it makes the film so much more memorable because of it. Tombstone's a classic film, as far as I'm concerned. And while it isn't flawless, it's a solid piece of Kurt Russell's filmography, and I'm glad you started with it, because it's such a fun movie to indulge yourself with on a lazy afternoon. Movie Matt Sorois says, what makes Kurt Russell so appealing? He's got the classic tough guy persona of Charles Bronson, the coolness of Steve McQueen, the quiet confidence of James Coburn, and the charisma of Harrison Ford. He somehow manages to be both an everyman and a badass action hero, equally capable of comedy and action. He's all that and more, plus his track record of appearing in awesome movies helps. Matthew Davis says, the thing with huge cast list movies like Tombstone, they can either be really, really good or really, really bad. Kurt Russell has an extremely varied catalog. Comedy, drama, western, action, sci-fi. He was also a kid actor who made the successful transition to adult actor. The Jungle Kid on an episode of Gilligan's Island, for Pete's sake. This will be an interesting and fun podcast. I don't expect to be doing any of the television shows, obviously, but he was also in Lost in Space. A very varied career. Diablo Frank left a dime store novel at my doorstep among his reflections. Kurt Russell cast is an interesting angle. Russell's an odd case where he's definitely a long-serving, intergenerational movie star, but he's never been especially bankable at the box office. He's kind of a beloved jobber. It took him 8 years, mostly in the Disney mines, to finally get a starring role in the Computer War 10 issues, which we just covered, and then another 2 years to play straight man to a monkey in The Barefoot Executive, then, Now You See Him, Now You Don't, the following year. He doesn't get a TV show until 12 years into his career, and it gets canceled 6 episodes in, going right back to Disney slop with The Strongest Man in the World. Then a failed pilot turned movie of the week, before finally getting positive notice in a serious role, another TV movie on the Charles Whitman spree killing. 14 years in, Russell finally gets a string of successful TV westerns and a single season of the follow-up TV series The Quest. It isn't until 1979, nearly 20 years into his career, that he finally gets enough eyes on him to make a star turn in Elvis, and that's still on TV. Then Used Cars flopped, but Escape from New York was a hit with an iconic anti-hero role that finally established Russell in year 19, only for the notorious failure of The Thing to put him right back on thin ice. And that's pretty much the rest of his career. A lot of supporting and third lead work, punctuated by the occasional hit, soon followed by another dud. The 90s were his only period of sustained success, but even then, people scratched their heads as to why Sylvester Stallone would share a billing with him, or get mad that they'd been bait and switched on what they thought was a Steven Seagal picture. I think they came out ahead on that one, Craig Frank. It's like, who doesn't love Kurt Russell, but also, who will actually make a point of lining up for every one of his movies on opening or often any day? In JLA terms, he's what? A Green Arrow? Does that make Goldie Hawn Black Canary? I personally love Green Arrow, so maybe this tracks. On Tombstone itself, he says there's a video of Michael Biehn circulating where he emphatically states that Tombstone was directed by committee when the first month's footage by Kevin Jarry was thrown out after his firing. George Cosmatos was still the director, but it was past the last minute, and he was mostly concerned with the visuals. It seems that Russell and Kilmer bonded on the set, and that they seemed to have a lot of input on their scenes, plus there were a lot of conflicts with Cosmatos over his abusive presence on set. So we weren't too wrong when we said it feels like, or it looked like, or there was evidence that. Kurt Russell was a stronger influence on this film than the director. Siskoid Cinema's No Escape from Kurt Russell is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. So if you're listening to this and have your own opinions about what we've discussed, please feel free to head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com to leave a comment. I'll read them on our next episode. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/FW Podcasts. So we're done here, so cut it, print it. A guy that craves animation, otherwise dares to hold our human race. Making the news and his dues that turned on outside, that out of sight, totally together, computer antenna shoes.